Hello and welcome back to the concluding part of our mini-series on the 43 group of British Jewish ex-servicemen and women who fought Oswald Mosley's fascists in the streets after World War II. If you haven't heard parts 1 and 2 yet, I would go back and listen to those first.
Alla mattina, appena alzata, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao alla mattina.
My parents were born in East London during the war, and they've both told me about just the absolute devastation and poverty that they grew up around. It's worth bearing in mind that bombing by the Nazis damaged or destroyed over a million homes in the city. Jules Konopinski was there too, as were many others who formed the backbone of the 43 group, which included some of the East End underworld, like the Goldberg brothers.
Goldberg brothers, look, you have in every society people of different characters. You probably cannot imagine what it was like in 1944, from 1939 to 1950 in the East End of London. You had poverty. You had, the place was bombed to pieces. Nothing was standing. People lived, you don't know how people managed to live in a first floor room in a house where the whole ground floor was crumbling. And the Goldbergs came from a very poor family in the East End. And the main trade in those days was the cabinet making trade and the rag trade. And they were both pressers. And I say pressers, they didn't press the suits. They opened the seams up. I don't know if you know, when you do a seam, you have to open it up and fold it flat. And they used a hand iron. And when you're using a hand iron like that all the time, you become strong, and your arm becomes physically strong. And they were strong guys, and they were poverty-stricken, but they were also, had lost a brother years earlier, and they lived in Brady Street, and they had been on the receiving end of almost this pre-war nonsense. And so they were vicious. They were vicious people. And they love to hurt. And when they went and do something, they hurt. So they, if you wanted to really hurt somebody, physically hurt somebody, you sent these to do a certain job. You wouldn't send a powder puff man in who'd do on the jaw and then walk away. They hurt people. And we had all kinds, and they, and once they got going, they never stopped. But in fact, I know for a fact that in those days, the Cray brothers, the gangsters of the East End, were just coming up as kids, the same age. They want nothing to do with the Goldberg twins, even when they got more famous. Because the only way they could have contained those would have been to send in half dozen or more of their own heavies. But the Goldbergs wouldn't have given in. They'd have got killed to the end. They were wonderful people. Well, there were other people like them as well in the East End. A lot of people liked them in the East End.
Another central figure in the group was Jerry Flamberg, who was involved in the very first confrontation with fascist Geoffrey Ham, which preceded the founding of the group.
Jerry Flamberg was one of three brothers. They lived in King Edward Road in a poor family. He became famous, if you will, at in the airborne, and he was wounded at the Battle of the Bridge of One Bridge Too Far. You've seen the film, and even though he was injured, he managed to knock out the tank single-handed, for which he was awarded the Military Medal, and then he was captured and became a prisoner of war. And even while as a prisoner of war in one of the heavy Stalags, they even formed a youth club, the Brunswick Boys Club, amongst the people in the club. So there was somebody who was a prisoner of war, thinking of the future for the youth of the country. So he was a good man.
People who studied the history of the British Union of Fascists in the 1930s will know that when local residents, workers, Jewish people and anti-fascists tried to confront the fascists up and down the country and prevent them from marching through often Jewish working class areas, it was the police whose job it was to protect the fascists and fight their way through local people to facilitate the fascist marches. After World War II, history repeated itself as Daniel Sonnabend, author of We Fight Fascists, the 43 Group and Their Forgotten Battle for Post-War Britain, explains.
One group of people who unsurprisingly did not respond well to the 43 Group were the police. Many group members were arrested, normally at street meetings. Far more group members and Jews would be arrested than fascists, and many of these group members received beatings from the police. The head of G Division, which was the division that was in charge of Dalston, where most of the violence took place, was a man called Charles Satherwaite, who one 43 Group member said to me, would have done very well at Belsen. And many of the group thought that he had very strong fascist sympathies, and he, on several occasions, beat up Jewish people in prison cells. And many people, including Vidal Sassoon, at that point, apprentice hairdresser who would sort of restyle the world, received beatings from the police and often, you know, accompanied with deeply horrible anti-Semitic invective. And there was a clear prejudice, in the group's eyes at least, from the police, who they saw as being in sympathy with the fascists. They didn't think this was sort of covered all police. They thought that often police who had ex-service ribbons on their uniforms tended to be more sympathetic. Some might hear a sort of given one from me, from a policeman, and sometimes, you know, they might, you know, if they mentioned their service record, a policeman might sort of release them. And the 43 Group themselves were willing to work with the police. They often handed over information, especially to Special Branch. And one of the founding members, a guy called Len Sherman, often trained with the police. He was a martial arts expert, so yeah. He sparred with them. So there was not an antipathy towards the police from the group, but there was very much the sense that the police favoured the fascists. In part, this might have been down to anti-Semitic prejudices, or the police failing to, or continually confusing the 43 Group with the communists. I mean, they all looked the same. They were mostly all Jews from East London, so they didn't look too different from each other. But they just thought they were sort of annoying communist agitators. Also, because of the Public Order Act, the police were often guarding the fascist platforms, which meant in order for the group to get to the fascists, they had to get through the police. So that naturally put them on opposing sides. That very much antagonised the police to them. But it was clear that there was prejudice, and one of the North London magistrates actually, when sentencing some group members, at one point said he encouraged the police next time to bring the platform, to bring the fascist speakers, because if they were going there into Jewish areas to agitate, then, you know, they were clearly as responsible for the violence as those people who were attacking them.
Special Branch, which Dan just mentioned, was the political police force, focused on things like national security. They were first set up in Britain to fight Irish Republicans. As an example of police attitudes, Jules explains what happened to him one day when police caught him as the 43 Group tried to shut down an indoor fascist meeting which the police were protecting.
In the alleyway on the corner of Kensington High Street and Church Street, and you had like a war memorial on the corner and an alleyway, and in the back was the police station. They took me in there, didn't say nothing, because what I did was, at that time, mostly had a Maltese, and my mad intention was to go over and do him, cut him. And I went forward and the police horses virtually dropped on me. I remember all the guys trying to pull me out. And they managed to get me out, but not completely. So here I'm under the police horses. And then the police took me out and took me into the alleyway and gave me a good hiding in there. But never showed a mark. They held my arms, held my feet down, and just bashed my belly. And I went next door because my friend Percy Jacobs, by the West End Central crowd, who lived in Paramount Court, they all came out of the area. His mother had a shop, a ladies' lingerie shop there. That was a bit of a state. And I ended up, I think, next day at West London Police Court, somewhere in Olympia.
This incident took place during a short time window when the fascists hired a group of Maltese gangsters to help protect them. Dan talks about this in more detail in his book. Of course, at the same time all this was going on, in areas where the fascists were organised enough, as in the 1930s, they would also attack workers' or left-wing meetings. But strangely enough, the police never deemed any workers' meetings as worthy of protection.
So the police often claim that they were just merely doing their duty to protect free speech when they were protecting the fascists, but there were no known incidents of the police protecting communist meetings or the police protecting 43 group meetings when the group started to hold their own meetings. The one incident in December 1948 really shows the discrepancy between the protection the police gave to the fascists and the police gave to the communists. Often, you know, if Mosley was holding a big meeting, he would tell the police and there would be, you know, the police would pull a line, a cordon outside to make sure that no anti-fascist protesters got in to the building. However, in the winter of 1948, at a meeting at Stoke Newington Town Hall, Hewlett Johnson, who was called the Red Dean of Canterbury, a very sort of left-wing churchman, addressed a sort of communist meeting. And I believe protection was requested, and not only was it given, absolutely no attempt was made by the police to stop a fascist trying to invade the hall and then throwing, I think almost Molotov cocktails at the hall, and it was left for the 43 group to defend the hall by themselves with their communist allies. And when the police came, they sort of rounded up the same number of 43 group members as they did fascists. And so they might have said that they were just protecting the fascists because, you know, protecting their right to speech, but they offered none of the same protection to the communists.
Another factor which contributed to the general antipathy of the police to the 43 group and Jewish people in general was the fact that many of the local ones in London had been stationed in Palestine.
And then, of course, then came the other strange thing that when Britain eventually left Palestine to its own accord, the policemen who came back to England, who I must admit had been under a lot of pressure in Palestine, they'd been under pressure from the regular Jewish population, the Irgun, Zvi, Lehi, all the different parties who wanted self-determination, they'd been under pressure. And physical pressure. When they came back, the Home Secretary or somebody at the Home Office decided to place them in and around G Division. G Division is the area governing the area of Tottenham, Dalston, the East End, the Jewish area. And suddenly you had a reinforcement. So the right-wing parties at their demonstrations were reinforced by British police with their natural antipathy towards Jews. So, you know, things went from worse to worse till eventually the riots got so bad that something had to be done. And the government stepped in, did something.
The action Jules is referring to here is that on a few occasions, clashes taking place between fascists and anti-fascists in Dalston, East London, escalated to such an extent that public meetings were banned for months at a time. As the notoriety of the 43 group grew, it elicited a range of reactions from the Jewish community.
The reaction of the Jewish community to the 43 group was decidedly mixed. The group did have some support, including from some very wealthy backers who were able to financially support it throughout its existence. And plenty of the families of many of the members were very supportive of what their children were doing, even if they were slightly worried about them getting arrested, getting injured, etc. However, there was a lot of opposition to the 43 group, especially from older members of the community or people who didn't approve of what they were doing. Particularly strong opposition came from the Board of Deputies, who hated the 43 group. Hated the 43 group probably more than the fascists did. The Board of Deputies had a committee called the Jewish Defence Committee, which was responsible for combating fascism and dealing with anti-Semitism. That was led by a man called Louis Heidelman. And in the pages of the Jewish Chronicle, throughout the existence of the 43 group, Heidelman and the group's chairman, Jeffrey Bernard, frequently sparred, insulted each other and argued. And there was a real antipathy from the Board of Deputies and from Heidelman, who really just wanted the 43 group to go away, to behave themselves. They frequently tried to get the 43 group to sort of merge back with Ajax, or to sort of close down, or just reform as just a sports group. But throughout the group's existence, they were trying to do everything in their power to make the group go away.
As a teenager, Jules' parents were very worried about him, and they didn't want him getting mixed up in street fights.
I inflicted great harm and aggravation to my parents. It's in the book, it's an incident which is so true. In the middle of a bloody riot, my mother turns up and grabs hold of Jeffrey Bernard, the organiser, and she, if she'd had an umbrella in her hand, she might have hit him with the umbrella. And she says, "What are you doing to my son? Why are you getting you into trouble all the time?" And his answer was, "Madam, I couldn't stop your son. I couldn't influence him anyway. He's got a mind of his own, and that was me."
Over time, the 43 group grew considerably and expanded to cover other areas where there were both Jewish communities as well as fascists trying to organise.
It's estimated that at its peak, which was probably around the spring and summer of 1948, the 43 group had around 2,000 members, of which probably only a few hundred were really active and were really turning out to meetings. But it was a large membership organisation and had ways of sort of giving work to people who were more casual members. It was always primarily a London-based organisation, but it's had regional branches in other cities. Some of these regional branches were pre-existing organisations that affiliated with the 43 group. For instance, in Manchester, there was the Manchester Union of Jewish Ex-Servicemen, which affiliated with the group. There was another organisation in Newcastle, which changed its name to the 43 group, and other 43 group regional branches were present around the country. In the spring and summer of 1948, a new fascist organisation emerged called the Union Movement. This was set up by Oswald Mosley, who had returned to politics at the end of 47. And what he'd done with the Union Movement is he'd taken all these sort of small fascist organisations that had been dotted around the country from the end of the war, including the League and the Union of British Freedom and several other organisations like that, along with 54 Mosleyite book clubs, which had been sort of servicing the needs of fascist members. And he brought them all together as the Union Movement, which became the first nationwide fascist organisation since after the war and since the BUF. And in this sort of the summer of 1940, spring and summer of 1948, they sort of took Union Movement meetings around the country. And there was normally anti-fascist presence there, either the 43 group sent members, or they had affiliated organisations, or locals turned up to oppose the fascists in areas around the country.
As is always the case with anti-fascist organising, a crucial part of the work is legal support.
One of the ways that many members could contribute who didn't want to fight was through helping to fundraise for the group. The group put on lots of different social events, and they sent people round knocking on doors asking for money, and fundraising was a massively important part of the group. And one of the reasons for that was because the group's actions incurred both medical costs for anybody who got injured and legal costs. The group covered all costs always. It covered the cost of lawyers, and it covered the costs if there was a fine or a penalty of some sort imposed by the courts. The group would always cover that. The group had some very, very fine lawyers represent its members who were arrested and appeared in court, including two Labour politicians who were also practising barristers, a man called John Platts Mills and another man called D.M. Pritt. On one incident, and this shows the sort of the lengths that the group was willing to go to, two of their members, its founder and co-chairman Jerry Flamberg, and another member called Johnny Wimborne, who was one of its intelligence heads, were tried for attempted murder of a fascist called John Preen. And the 43 group hired a man called David Maxwell Fife, who was a former attorney general who'd go on to become Home Secretary, who had just returned from prosecuting Nazis at Nuremberg. He was one of the most well-known lawyers at the time, and the 43 group got him to represent them at the first magistrates' court hearing. And I was talking to the brother of the group's lead solicitor who was in the room on that day, and he said he couldn't believe the shock of the magistrate's face that this most famous lawyer was in his small magistrate's court. But the group really took the defence of its members seriously. At an event I was doing a couple of weeks ago, one of the sons of one of the members was there, and he stood up and he said, "My dad always said you could divide the 43 group into two halves. There were those who got themselves into trouble, and there were those who got them out of trouble. There were those who fight, and there were those who sort of represent them. But the group always paid the bills. It always covered the legal costs, the medical costs, and I don't know to what extent they could offer support when people were in prison. I think the longest someone was sent to prison for was a month. I don't know, but I'm sure whatever ways they could look after them and cover their costs, they absolutely would. They saw that as absolutely pivotal. The group saw itself as a brotherhood. It was a membership organisation which really took care of its own. It was no man left behind. It was, you're always there for each other, you stand up for each other, and you look after each other. And that was absolutely pivotal to its organising.
In Dan's book, there's an aspect of the attempted murder case which I think is a great little anecdote, which is that most people in the 43 group in London were members of a private members' club. And on nights when they planned on engaging in some mischief, they would often sign into the club, leave through the back door, do whatever it was they were going to do, and then sneak back into the club with their signatures on the door as alibis. So they even used the fact that they hadn't signed into the club to generate false alibis as part of their potential defence. Jules once had need of legal support from the group after he was arrested in Dalston.
You try to avoid arrest by being clever. As I said, if the police are pushing that way, have your back to them, therefore you're never actually pushing or physically pushing. You are backward, but you're not actually seen to be doing so. And police have to have some sort of witness statement if they wanted to charge you something seriously. But I was arrested on a minor thing at a meeting at John Campbell Road, which is a street opposite Ridley Road, a cinema on the corner. It was a place where if they couldn't get the main square, they'd go there. And it was a simple thing, very small little fracas, and seven people were arrested that day. And we appeared next week at North London Magistrates Court, or the next day actually, at North London Magistrates Court on a simple charge of insulting behaviour, nothing. And then they said, come down back to the charge room, and they charged us with threatening behaviour. They said, I've got the, in fact, you found the paperwork. And then after 3 weeks, they charged us with a fray called a breach of peace. And that would have been a 5-year prison sentence. And it didn't need a lot of proving, because that's a charge a police can prove very easily. And it was only some last couple of years ago that our friend found in the files in Richmond in the archives the actual police report and the letters written and signed by the policeman in charge, who happened to be a chief superintendent Satterthwaite, a known anti-Semite, who took great pleasure in putting us first. But we could never prove anything until you saw the actual wording, where he says, he didn't say a trouble started and the public moved forward towards the platform. He says, the Jews moved forward. Right? The Jews did that, and the Jews did this. And then we had him arrested. Pointed out this one, that one, that one, that one. So he pinpointed those he wanted. And then he actually wrote saying that he would like these people specifically prosecuted. He wrote to the DPP in those days. So we had the chief police area for the area very much against us.
The police report about the incident where Jules was arrested does indeed talk about, quote, the Jews. And Jules was arrested with seven other people. Three of the group allegedly were found in possession of offensive weapons, including electric light bulbs, razor blades, a large horseshoe, and an iron bar covered in rubber. A leather-encased steel truncheon was also apparently found at the scene. Jules had a razor blade and a holder on him as well, which Jules said he needed for his work in the leather trade. He also had a light bulb, which he said that he found and thought might come in useful. The police report does at least concede that Jules, quote, possibly meant to convey that the electric light bulb might be useful for domestic or other legitimate purposes, but goes on to say that they were aware that bulbs had been thrown at similar meetings. And the report does go on to say that, quote, the light bulb in this case was of the screw-in pattern, not at all in general use. As in the UK at the time, most light bulbs had bayonet tops. Jules ended up getting into quite an amusing altercation with the anti-Semitic police chief in the courtroom.
Saturated long been, as I said to you, as a world known, and at the Old Bailey in giving evidence, he was arrogant and he was lying. I thought that as he was being in court actually showing his arrogance, that when I hated the bastard, that as I walked past him, I pretended to be hit by him and went down on the floor and said, don't hit me. And the judge reprimanded the chief superintendent, saying, you can't do that in my court, you can't.
In the end, after a four-day trial, Jules was acquitted, although most of his co-defendants were convicted of unlawful assembly or assaulting police and fined between £5 and £20 each, which translates to about £70 to £300 in today's money. Members of the 43 group were generally trying to avoid arrest. However, on one occasion, when Jerry Flamberg and some others got picked up by police, they insisted on being charged to try to take advantage of their decorated veteran status for publicity.
Some of us got arrested purposely, sometimes, to bring it into the open air. VCs, when all those guys, the decorated people and war heroes, and my own wife's cousin, Alex Carson, was at the DFC. When they were arrested in the police station, the cop in charge said, I can't take you to the police station. They laughed. All these decorated people. And they said, you can go home. They said, no, we're not going home. We demand that you charge us, and we want our day in court. And they got it. And of course, next day, the whole it was flashed. Decorated war heroes, blah, blah, blah. And that's the first time, really, the British public took all this seriously. Before which, they looked upon it as hooligans, political parties, blah, blah, blah. It was really considered as a serious event because people got themselves arrested. They got off. But they wanted their time in court. They wanted to tell their story. And they did.
While some liberal commentators often claim that taking direct action against fascists discredits anti-fascism or somehow pushes more people to support or become fascists, the actual events in the late 1940s, as in the 1930s, shows the exact opposite effect.
One of Mosley's hopes was that he believed that at some point in the 1940s there was going to be a major economic crash, which he was not wrong to predict this, although it didn't happen, the conditions were very much there. And he believed that in such a time the British public would desire strong, responsible leadership, and that they would turn to him as somebody who could provide that. And so he had this very strong desire that fascism in the post-war years would appear respectable. So for the 43 group, for continuing to attack the fascists and associate fascist meetings with street violence, it reminded the British public that the fascists were no better than hooligans and street fighters, and that they were not responsible in any way for... could not be trusted as leaders in any way, and Mosley was not to be trusted. Mosley was nothing more than the leader of thugs. And so this was very effective in ensuring that when the fascist names and the fascists were in the press, they were being associated with violence, they were being associated with hooliganism, and that this really frustrated Mosley's desires to want to form a respectable organisation. And then in sort of You see him sort of in the summer of 1948, or sort of autumn of 1948, telling his followers that they shouldn't attack the Jews as much anymore. They'd always kind of use coded language. But he tells, talk about international bankers and communists and that sort of thing. But he tells them sort of dial that back, and he dialed that back on, dial back their attacks on Churchill, who was another one of their big enemies. And this actually really infuriates much of the core membership, who really just, want to lean into their prejudices and their hatred. And so at the start of 1949, he goes back on all of that, and they sort of begin to lean into their Nazism. They start saluting each other and putting and wearing black shirts again, or sort of singing an English version of the Nazi anthem, the Horst Wessel Lied, which really shows them sort of beginning to lean into that Nazism, shows they have no hope of attracting anybody outside the fascist circle, anyone who's not a rabid fascist, and that they just want to sort of dress up how they want to dress up and salute each other. And that kind of shows that they sort of completely given up the public relations battle.
In addition to helping swing public opinion against the fascists, the 43 group were able to cause significant disruption to fascist organising and cause them to shed members and activists.
It is without a doubt the case that had the 43 group not been there, the fascists would have had a much easier time of it. While the fascists might never have been successful in the post-war years, that maybe the time was probably not right for them, although you could argue the case either way, they could have very much had an easier ride. And what the 43 group did was, by constantly turning up to their meetings and by starting fights, they were communicating to all of those fascists who were more casual members, or who might have gone up to sort of beat up a Jew but didn't fancy going the other way, it deterred them from turning up to meetings. And it made sure that only the most zealous members were turning up. But the 43 group sort of frustrated fascist activities in lots of different ways, many of which weren't as obvious. They were always conscious that the fascists were trying to book meeting halls under different names, which hid the fact they were fascists. So whenever the group discovered that they were doing so, they would often contact the venues, and the venues would then often cancel, especially if the 43 group told them what sort of violence could happen if they didn't cancel. The group's spies were often passing information which allowed the 43 group to hinder fascist activities. The 43 group really made sure that the fascists were having a rough time of it. And frequently, when the fascists held a meeting which wasn't disrupted by the 43 group, they would boast about how the 43 group hadn't managed to find them this time, which really showed that in a game of cat and mouse, they were the mice, they were on the run. So the 43 group really put the fascists on the back foot and made them made it much more difficult. Then when fascists started leaving Mosley and leaving his organisations, which really began in 1948, many of them began to work for the 43 group, stood on their platforms and sort of talked about the lies that the fascists would tell. And that this kind of showed that they respected that the work the 43 group had done to frustrate the fascists, and they were the best people to work with if they also wanted to get their own back on Mosley.
By the end of the 1940s, the financial crisis Mosley predicted hadn't come to pass, and all of the fascist organisations were essentially moribund. The members of the 43 group were exhausted and were under escalating pressure from the Jewish communal leadership to merge into the Board of Deputies Association for Jewish Ex-Servicemen, AJEX.
So the group disbands in June 1950. It does so mostly because it sees its job as being done. Mosley had come back in 1948, and after several major defeats, which really checked his progress, his union movement had sort of stumbled along through the end of 1948 and 1949. A couple more big meetings were held, but progress was checked, and the numbers of the union movement began to seriously diminish. And so it was really becoming clear to many of the members, and sort of many of the founding members had of the 43 group had sort of left by this point. But towards the end of 1949, the fascists just weren't really a threat anymore. Yes, there were some very nasty incidents when they sort of were targeting, an incident in the spring of 1949 when two Jewish boys were just beaten up on the street by fascists. And they were still posing a small threat to the community, but sort of from a political point of view, that threat was gone. And when they were holding street meetings, nobody was really turning up. And as a result, the 43 group, which now its membership was predominantly much younger than it had been, most of the members hadn't fought it sort of had this new wave of younger members who were just looking for a fight. The 43 group didn't really have anything to direct these young energies at. It was almost becoming a bit of a powder keg. It was sort of starting to turn on Ajax a bit more. So I think the group realized sort of in 1950 it had to disband. Originally it wanted to sort of merge back in with Ajax and with what was called the official defense structure. It wanted to merged back in and wanted to sort of change the way sort of Ajax confronted fascism, so it became more active and sort of mirrored the group. But it quickly realised that wasn't going to happen. In June 1950, at a meeting in Holborn in central London, the group votes to disband unilaterally.
After years of hard and dangerous work, many 43 group members were relieved just to be able to return to normal life, with at least some reassurance that the official Jewish organisations would pick up their fight when necessary.
We disbanded because the Jewish authorities said, leave us, leave it to us. And all the members were so pleased to go home.
This didn't really happen, as we discuss in today's bonus episode for our Patreon supporters. But for the time being, the fascist threat had subsided. Big fascist meetings had ended, there was no sizable functioning fascist organisation anymore, and Oswald Mosley himself became depressed and disheartened with the possibilities of British fascism and so moved abroad, and started getting much more into the idea of pan-European nationalism. And this was quite off-putting to many British fascists, who liked to think that, as Brits, they're uniquely brilliant and didn't particularly like foreigners of any race. From his 6 years of studying the history of the 43 group, Dan thinks that there are a lot of lessons which can be learned from their experiences, which sadly are just as relevant today.
There are two major lessons, and this is what I argue at sort of the end of my book, that we can take from the 43 group. The first is one about knowing who the 43 group were and understanding what they did in that context. These were people who had seen what fascism does when it goes unchecked. They had seen the concentration camps, they had seen the war-torn battlefields of Europe. And so when they returned home to their homes and saw the kernels, sort of the seeds of fascism on the streets, they knew that it was better to have a bit of violence now, to have a few fights and to beat a few people up and to potentially get yourself beaten up or get thrown into prison. That is a better option than it is to let fascism grow unchecked. And that when it gets to the stage that the only way you can deal with it is with tanks. It is better to sacrifice your own moral standings against violence, which can be narcissistic, and understand that it's better that if you can do something to stop this, to leave behind those moral compunctions which say that, oh no, I don't believe in violence, oh no, I think we should talk to people, I think we should reason with people. Because fascism doesn't talk, fascism doesn't reason, it's not interested in that. It's a philosophy of violence that only understands violence. And the 43 group understood that, and they understood that the only way to combat fascism is with the language it understands. And it's better to do that on the streets with your fists, and potentially with a bit of a lead piping or, you know, a knuckle duster, than it is to do it with guns. Another lesson I think that particularly minority communities can take from this story is the 43 group really gave its membership, its Jewish membership, a sense of pride. The sense that you're standing up as Jews. We're not going to take this lying down. You see us as victims, but we're not victims, and we can stand up and fight. I've had the privilege of interviewing around a dozen of its members over the past few years, and the few who are still around, and you know, they really talk with pride about what they did. It really, you know, so much of their identity as Jewish people is based around the fact that they stood up and they fought for who they are. So I think standing up for one's community, you know, when one is being attacked, and standing up for those who in your community who cannot stand up for themselves, is a lesson that many can take from this. However, I think the most important lesson is to do with knowing who's on your side and who's not on your side. The 43 group said, if you're against fascists, you're with us. And that's the only thing that matters. Because the fascists, they don't want any form of difference. They will kill us all. You know, if we disagree with them, or we're not who they want us to be, they'll kill us. And that's all of us, no matter whether we're liberals or socialists or Trotskyists or Lenin or whoever it is, they will kill us. And therefore, we have to stand together. and that means we have to know the difference between a fascist and someone we just disagree with. Calling a conservative a fascist means that you do your force away the most important allies you have in the battle against fascism. The 43 group said, if you're against fascism, you're with us, no matter anything else. That's the only thing that matters. It means you're standing up for democracy. It means you're standing up for people's rights, the right for people to be who they want to be, be who they are, and be proud of that, and not have to hide that. And that is the most important thing, to come together as anti-fascists, to stand up for each other and to know who the enemy is more important than anything else.
It can get quite frustrating to see how many people on the left do rush to call things that they don't like fascist, and it can be quite counterproductive. I can't count the number of times people have commented on our social media posts about Oswald Mosley, say, or the German Nazi Party, and make comparisons to people like Boris Johnson. Now, of course, Boris Johnson is racist, homophobic, sexist, elitist, anti-working class, and all the rest of it. But he is not a fascist who is going to put us all in death camps. And this can do a real disservice to anti-fascism, because if you take that idea to its logical conclusion, then it means that trying to attack and shut down meetings of your local Conservative Party is a good idea. And we would hope people would realise that's actually a very bad idea and would be quite counterproductive. Whereas anything which can disrupt the organisation and growth of an organised fascist movement is worth supporting. And that also lends credence to the idea, which is becoming worryingly prominent these days, that anti-fascists are really people who want to use violence to suppress anyone who disagrees with them, including run-of-the-mill conservatives, because this is simply not the case, and the historical record on it is very clear. In every instance, militant anti-fascists in Britain and elsewhere have just taken proportionate, violent direct action against fascists. Against Mosley in the 1930s and 40s, and again in the 1960s, which we'll discuss in today's bonus episode. And later on, when a new generation of anti-fascists took on the National Front in the 1970s, and the British National Party in the 80s and 90s. And they didn't then go on to start shutting down Tory party meetings, or stopping free speech or anything like that. Once the fascist threat subsided, so did the anti-fascist organising. At the same time, the historical evidence is equally clear that fascism can't be stopped by polite debate alone. And if it's not stopped while fascist groups are small, then the 20th century has shown very clearly what kind of violence, genocide, and mass murder inevitably results if fascism takes hold in a society. As we mentioned earlier, when Oswald Mosley attempted yet another comeback in the 1950s and 60s, despite their promises to the contrary, the official Jewish organisations once again failed to take any serious action to combat them. So Jules and other veterans of the 43 group set up a new group, the 1962 Committee, often known as the 62 Group, to take the fight to the fascists once more. We've got a bonus episode about this for our Patreon supporters. If you don't support us yet, it's very easy. Just go to patreon.com/workingclasshistory. That's patreon.com/workingclasshistory. There you can sign up and get exclusive access to bonus episodes and other content. Link to it in the show notes. The more supporters we have, the more regularly we will be able to release episodes, and the more time we'll be able to spend working on WCH. Also, just a reminder that you can get Daniel's book, We Fight Fascists, where you can learn lots more about the 43 group in our online store, link in the show notes as well, with a discount for our patrons. Huge thanks to all of our existing supporters who make this podcast possible. We could not do it without you. Thanks to Disky Del Sole for permission to use our theme tune. Links to buy it and stream it in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and catch you next time. Mi diranno che bel fior, questo è il fiore.